Good morning. Welcome. My name is Katie Kingery Page, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. You're welcome here no matter who you love, no matter how you define yourself, wherever you come from, and no matter the burdens you carry. We are a community of seekers bound together by our common humanity. I'd like to point your attention to the announcements in the order of service, and in particular, the Circles Dinner, which I believe is upcoming. Yes? Good. Today, we are fortunate to have Reverend Sarah Oglesby Dunnigan, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Topeka, to lead us in our spiritual practice. Reverend Oglesby Dunnigan is one of the Unitarian ministers leading efforts statewide and nationwide to bring attention to growing income inequality and the need for social equity. She is currently a part of the Nationwide Poor People's Campaign and the board chair for Kansas Interfaith Action. Join me in welcoming Reverend Sarah.
Will you light the chalice for me as I say these words? May the flame we now rekindle call us back to our center and guide us back to our breath. May our chalice remind us that we are held and welcomed as we are. In this sanctuary of acceptance, may we remember that there is a place for our whole selves, a place where no piece of us has to hide.
We are all longing to go home, to some place we have never been, a place half remembered and half envisioned. We can only catch glimpses of from time to time. Community. Somewhere there are people to whom we can speak with passion without having the words catch in our throats. Somewhere a circle of hands will open to receive us. Eyes will light up as we enter. Voices will celebrate with us whenever we come into our own power. Community means strength that joins our strength to do the work that needs to be done. Arms to hold us when we falter, a circle of healing, a circle of friends, someplace where we can be free. May our time together be another step on our journey home.
Our listening creates a sanctuary for the homeless parts within each person, for the homeless parts within the others around us. Won't you listen to Renee sing the first verse of this song, and then we'll all join in.
Thank you.
you want to join me up front, you would be welcome. No matter what your age is or your size. What an awesome group. Good morning. So my story comes from a long time ago, before World War II. It begins with a 12-year-old named Sammy Lee, who lived in California. And he used to go by a local public swimming pool. What does public mean? Should mean to everybody, right? But in 1932, do some of the people in this room remember? Was that true? No. In 1932, public did not mean everybody. And Sammy was Korean. And at that time, the pools were only open to people who were considered to be white every day of the week except Wednesday. Is that right? What do you think about that? That's not very cool, right? And he used to go, there were chain link fence outside the swimming pool, and he would go and watch the other kids swimming, wait for the one day a week that he was allowed to swim. That was on Wednesday. Does anybody know why they picked Wednesday? It's not a very nice reason. But I think it's important for us to be honest, because if we don't want to do the same things today that we did in the past, we need to know what we did that wasn't nice. So they picked Wednesday because Thursday was the day they cleaned the pool. So they let all the kids who were considered to be not white were allowed to swim on Wednesday because that's when the pool was the least clean. That seems pretty awful, right? But that's what they did. And he would go and he would watch. And one of the things he really loved was the diving board. And he watched some other kids on the days that weren't Wednesday learning how to dive. And he decided, I want to do that, right? It looks really cool. How many of you have ever dived off the diving board? Yeah. How many of you have dived off the high dive, like the really high one? That's awesome, right? And how many of you have seen people do like flips and stuff off of it? Yes, so that's so cool, right? And he thought, I want to learn how to do that. So on Wednesdays, that one day a week that he was allowed in the pool, he would go and practice diving. And it felt like flying, except for sometimes what happens when you don't do a dive well? Yeah, you can hurt yourself with a belly flop. So that happened to him on more than one occasion. He made a couple friends who knew how to do things he didn't know how to do, who taught him how to do somersaults in the air and do fun stuff. And his father, who owned a grocery store, used to tell him, in America, you can achieve anything if you set your heart to it. And so Sammy wondered what that would be for him. He wondered what it would be for him. And then one day in Los Angeles, they were driving through and they saw a whole bunch of flags in the middle of town from all these different countries. What do you think that was for? When are there a bunch of flags in your community from other countries? It was for the Olympics. Have you guys watched the Olympics before? Yeah, so he saw those flags and he thought, I want to be an Olympic champion. And so he kept working on his diving, and he knew he'd need to have, what do you need to have to go to the Olympics? What kind of helper would you probably need? You might need a coach, right? So he went to a diving competition, and in between the competitions, he started practicing his diving, and this old guy came up to him. This was the summer of 1938, and he was 18 years old. And this guy came up to him while he was diving and said, that was the lousiest dive I've ever seen. Ugh. But then what did he do? He made him get out of the pool and do it over and over again and started giving him all these instructions. And he started getting better right there in that moment. And then at the end he said, I'm Jim Ryan, and I'm your new coach. So he didn't even have to go look for a coach. A coach just sort of showed up and said, I want to work with you. Now, the rules about the pool didn't change, and so he could only practice on Wednesdays, which wasn't enough to get really good. So what they did, this is really creative, they went to Jim's farm, and they dug a huge hole. What do you think they were going to do with that hole? You'd think they'd put water in it, but they did something else really unique. They put sand in it. And he practiced diving into a big pit of sand. Does that sound like fun? He had to land on his feet or he would get hurt. And so he ended up also learning to do gymnastics so he'd have really strong legs so he could land in that sand without getting hurt. And he got sand everywhere. But he learned to be an incredible diver diving into sand because of this. Now, his dad really thought he should go to medical school, so he needed to get really good grades. His dad made him get really work on his homework. He was a straight-A student. But something happened to him his senior year. Even though he was the top in his class and he was going to get a full scholarship to go to college, he didn't get to go to his own prom because it was held in a building that non-white people were not allowed in. So you see, Sammy lived in a world that had a lot of closed doors. And his dad didn't really understand the diving thing. He really wanted him to be a doctor. And when he went off to college, his grades started to slip because he was so into diving. But after he and his dad sat down and talked for a little while, he realized that his dad wanted a better future for him. And so although he wasn't sure how that was going to happen, he kept trying out for the Olympics and entering diving competitions. He actually wanted to qualify for the Olympic Games in Helsinki in 1940. But what happened, older people in the audience? Maybe younger people know this. What happened in 1940? The World War II began, and they canceled the Olympics. So he wasn't able to go. And then his dad died of a heart attack. And he'd saved him a box full of money to help him with his future. And he used that money to go get some medical training through the United States Army. He joined a training program there and got his doctor's training by 1946. So when he was working in these different hospitals, he would visit pools that were near the hospital and go practice his diving. And he kept thinking, maybe the next Olympics, right? Maybe the next one, maybe the next one. And he's getting older. But he realizes that he still really wants to do this. So he enters and wins a high platform dive contest with the highest score ever. And he ends up being able to go to the 1948 Olympic Games in London. So he's 28 years old, and he qualifies to be on the Olympic diving team. And he does his first diving event. It was the 3-meter springboard. That's the normal one. And he does pretty well. He actually gets a bronze, but he doesn't want to settle for that. And he knows that the high platform one is the one that he's best at. So he gets up on the 10-meter platform, and he says, I'm going for the gold. And he no longer wanted to do it just for himself. He wanted to do it for his dad and for every kid who looked like him who wasn't able to get into the pool or wasn't treated the same in different establishments around town. So he decided to do a 3.5 somersault, which is a really dangerous one to do from the high dive. If you slightly do it wrong, you can actually get so badly hurt that you could actually die. It's a really hard dive. He was in front of a crowd of thousands of people, and he jumps off, and he does a nearly perfect dive. He got scores of 7.0, 9.0, 9.5, 4 times 9.5, and then he got a 10.0, and he did it. He took home the gold. And he stood on the platform, and he thought, I did it. But he didn't just do it for his father, but also for his coach and his country and all the people that cared about him and knew about him. And he remembered his father's words, in America, you can achieve anything if you set your heart to it. So here's what I want to ask you guys. Who helped Sammy? Who helped him? Did he do that by himself, getting the gold? He had a coach. Who else helped him? I saw someone back there. What do you think? Who else helped him?
His dad?
His friends, right? Remember, he had a friend at the pool that showed him how to do some dives. people on his team. So who helps you? Who helps you to do what you do? Well, hopefully there's a whole room full of people here who help you. Raise your hand over in this side of that room if you're willing to help these kids and teens out with things that they might need help with. Wow, you got a whole bunch of helpers over there. I bet some of those are your parents. And some of them aren't, right? So it's something to think about. Who helps us to do what it is we want to do? What do you love and what are you good at? Do you have a sense of what? So you guys who are older, do you have something you already know you're good at that you really love? I'm going to ask the older kids back here. Not sure yet? Too shy to tell me. Usually by the time we're teenagers, right? Those of us who are older than teenagers, you have some sense of what you might be good at and what you really love doing. It might not be the thing you build a career out of, but it might be. You might have a sport you love or an instrument you love to play. Renee, how old were you when you started playing music? Seven. And when did you know it was a passion and you loved it? Seven, right? So you guys here might know what you love and you're good at. You started music, and do you have somebody teach you? Your mom teaches you. What two things are you good at? Nice. I knew I loved reading too, and it might not be an obvious thing how somebody who loves reading would become a minister, but I think some of you can probably guess how those are connected. So today when you go to class, and this whole week, when you're thinking about what it is to be sanctuary, give me just a minute, I want you to think about what it is that other people do to help you pursue what you love and what you're good at, and who helps you. Okay? So we're actually going to sing you to class now, but if you have more questions after church, I'd be happy to talk to you.
The second Sunday of each month, we donate our offering to a community in need. This month, we make offering to the Crisis Center. I believe that Judy Davis joins us today. Welcome, Judy. Thank you for being here.
It's okay. I'm a microphonophobe. Some of you know that. Oh, get my star on. Get my diva on. I'm always very pleased to come to this fellowship. For one thing, I feel personally very safe here with all of my attitude, which is significant and growing all the time. As you know, we serve victims of sexual and domestic violence in Clay, Gary, Marshall, Pottawatomie, and Riley counties. Our services are free. They're all confidential. What you may not know is that we serve in the neighborhood of 1,200 individuals each year. And of that number, only about 150 to 200 require safe shelter. And it is to that safe shelter that your gifts, monetary and in kind, are always devoted. I thought it might help to give you, just to ground this a little bit. I'm very proud, first of all, to say that Crisis Center is the only domestic violence shelter in the state that doesn't turn people away because we get full. We don't do that. We may have to put them on a cot in the playroom or on a sofa, but we don't, if they live in our service region and they need safety, we're there for them no matter what. The consequence of that is that it's a complete zoo over there a whole lot of the time. For example, this summer I kept getting purchase requests for baby wipes. And we get lots of those donated and we send them over to shelter all the time. And we had a fairly new children's advocate, and so I called Chandler one day and I said, Chandler, we just keep sending over baby wipes, and we've gotten lots donated, and we purchased some, and I'm looking at another purchase order, and she said, Judy, there are 9 children in shelter who wear diapers at this point. And that sent me to looking specifically at the number of children we were serving during the summer. I was aware that it was really, really chaotic and challenging in the shelter. And for a foundation that helps support our children's advocate, I did a little spreadsheet, and I'm kind of embarrassed to say I was surprised to see that in our quietest month during the summer, we sheltered 22 different children of all ages. During our busiest month, we sheltered 26 different children. And in the busiest period, 2.5 weeks, we had 22 kids per day, ranging in age from newborn to, this is unusual, 17. We had 4 teenagers at once. That's a lot of milk and a lot of ice cream. So be assured that we need your support and that we appreciate it very, very much. And we will put anything you can do to good use in the service of others. Thank you.
We'll read How the Stars Get in Your Bones by Jan Richardson.
Sapphire, diamond, emerald, quartz. Think of every hard thing that carries its own brilliance, shining with the luster that comes only from uncountable ages in the earth, in the dark, buried beneath unimaginable weight, bearing what seems impossible, bearing it still.
And you, shouldering the grief you had thought so solid, so impermeable, the terrible anguish you carried as a burden, now become, who can say what day it happened, a beginning.
See how the sorrow in you slowly makes its own light, how it conjures its own fire. See how radiant even your despair has become in the grace of that sun.
Did you think this would happen by holding the weight of the world, by giving it into the press of sadness and time, I tell you, this blazing in you, it does not come by choosing the most difficult way, the most daunting. It does not come by the sheer force of your will.
It comes from the helpless place in you that, despite all, cannot help but hope. The part of you that does not know how not to keep turning toward this world, to keep turning your face toward this sky, to keep turning your heart toward this unendurable earth, knowing your heart will break, but turning it still.
I tell you, this is how the stars get in your bones. This is how the brightness makes a home in you. As you open to the hope that burnishes every fractured thing, it finds and sets it shimmering. A generous light that will not cease, no matter how deep the darkness grows, no matter how long the night becomes.
Still, 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 the secret of secrets keeps turning in you, becoming beautiful, becoming blessed, kindling the luminous way by which you will emerge, carrying your shattered heart like a constellation within you, singing to the day that will not fail to come.
From Susan Adamczyk, the joy of having her husband finally get out of the hospital and is now starting rehab at Stony Brook, and the concern of her friend Alan mentioned in a concern a few months ago, who has passed away last Sunday, less than 4 months after his diagnosis. She says, thanks to all who have sent kind thoughts during the past few weeks. And I invite us to just take a moment now to hold each of those things in our heart not ready to be shared into this room, but knowing that this room holds us anyway. This is a prayer for a fresh, unremarkable morning. A prayer to bring us to attention before the steadiness of the world. Sunrises and sunsets back and forth line the rocking of your grandmother's chair, life coming and going, rising and falling, droning and beating like ancient music, and you, remarkable for your ordinariness within it, and your thinking about it, and your yearning for meaning. You, dependent, spun into the interdependent web, confined to a body. You, independent, conscious, free, and so sometimes also lonely, but unconfined in spirit. This is a prayer for you, for your well-being, for your peace. Your deep peace. And for everyone you love and for their well-being. And for the friends we haven't met yet. And for the strangers we'll never meet. Though we are closer to them than we think. All of us and the arms of the earth. Our mother with her rocking and singing. Won't you join us in 1051?
Sings to the universe who we are.
these words from Marion Wright Edelman, the famous and effective children's advocate. I've tried to teach what I learned all those years in my mother and father's house, all those things I didn't realize I was learning and that I never knew I'd be so grateful for. When you have love and it's proffered every day in a kind of tender yet stern insistence and even reckless laughter, when it's given to you and you accept it in life as a thing as natural as rain or snow or the litter of leaves in the fall, you can't help but take it for granted. For a bewildered while, you incorrectly understand that the world has given you this love because it's there in equal measure everywhere. You never know until it's too late to do anything about it. How sweet the effort is, how lasting the human will to love can be in the breast of people who want to make it for you, who want to give it to you, without calculating what's in it for them, without thinking at all of what it will mean when you grow to full adulthood, see the world as it is, and forget to mention what you've been given. Every day in my grown-up life, I've wanted to do what my parents did. I've wanted to widen the province of love and weaken hate and bitterness in the hearts of my children. And I've done these things because of what I got from my family all those lovely years when I was growing up, being loved and cherished and unbeknown to me and in the best way, honored for myself.
Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund came up with the idea of a children's Sabbath in October as a way to invite faith communities to take a closer look at the threats to our future from the lens of our children, all children in our midst. In her book, The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation, she offers a call to action and a heartfelt plea for what the adults, all of us, parents, faith communities, neighborhood leaders, teachers, need to do to address the future of our human communities and our planet. And as a participant in the Poor People's Campaign here in Kansas, I found her ideas to be in complete alignment with this movement and the lens of the children's welfare to be a powerful and inspiring point of departure. I also felt her call to action from several roles that I'm living out as a mother, as a minister, and as a trusted adult in the lives of children in my community. So she addresses parents first and holds up the importance of parenting and having a community of support for parents, that we cannot be good parents alone. We need friends, we need family, we need congregations, other people who are committed to the well-being of our kids. And she asks parents to consider, what values do you want your kids to have in the midst of our individualistic, materialistic, and power-hungry culture? What goals do you have and want your kids to have? And what do we want success to look like for our kids? She notes that currently many college graduates are, when interviewed, more focused on money that they'll earn, on power that they'll have, and the external rewards of their degrees. She says that instead, we need to raise kids who are prepared to live in a multicultural, pluralistic world where differences are acknowledged and not minimized, and relationships are based on mutual respect despite our differences, where we're concerned about caring for each other and our planet and operate from a sense of communalism rather than individualism. The responsibility lies with us. She says, adults are what's wrong with kids. From too many screens to other teens as influencers, from the lack of supervision to the lack of extended community supports like church or family and neighbors, from promises we don't keep to the domination of addictions and violence, it's not just our food that is empty of meaningful and nourishing ingredients. She says quite unequivocally, we do not have a child and youth problem in the United States, but we do have a profound adult problem as our children do and what they see adults do. So kids need adults who will put them first. and she outlines our parent responsibilities. Make sure you know that your kids know that you love them unconditionally. Children need to be loved for who they are, she says, not what they achieve or just how they look. Be a good role model and a mentor for them. What they see and hear you saying and doing is what they will learn from and say and do. Really pay attention. I feel like in the age of cell phones, this is like such an important piece to grab onto. Really pay attention. It's your job to teach values and respect and manners, to create family rituals and consistency, like dinner together or movie nights, camping or serving others in the community, reading with our kids, teaching perseverance and tenacity, teaching them independence and interdependence, to be self-initiating and self-sustaining, and to teach them that they are powerful and can make a difference. She says, get to know your kids' friends and their parents because they're part of that circle of influence. Give children chores. I think this is my favorite one. Give children chores. I taught my 10-year-old to do her laundry in fifth grade. She's now 17. She can't believe that other kids don't do their own laundry. It helps them learn to be responsible for themselves, but also to something beyond themselves as well. Model apologizing. If you can't apologize, how will they know it's important? In her appraisal of education and her message to teachers and educators, she begins by noting the reality, and we see this in our state, the teachers are underpaid and undervalued, and we need to do better. Amen. We need to do better. To teachers, she says, the most important part of their work is in the relationships they build with students. As Nobel Prize winner Gabriela Mistral says, a love for children opens up more paths for teachers than pedagogic theory does. She tells teachers to build relationships with their students based on care and respect. If you don't love and respect all children and believe all children are sacred and expect to keep learning and growing yourself, you are in the wrong profession. Teachers have a duty to reflect constant commitment to justice and relationships with their students. If you cannot be fair to each child, she says, you will do harm. So the realities within our education system are stark. We can see that this isn't what's always happening. For example, 2/3 of fourth graders can't read at grade level, and 70% of eighth graders can't. When we look at this lens through the lens of race, we're doing an even worse job. Low-income kids drop out of school at 6 times the rate of higher-income kids, 6 times the rate, and kids of color are twice as likely as white kids to drop out. The school-to-prison pipeline is fed by zero-tolerance policies, and we lack restorative practices to replace these. We use officers in schools to over-discipline kids, especially kids of color, instead of trying to protect them from harm. Marion Wright Edelman advises that children misbehaving in school need help, not expulsion, arrest, and detention. So in our cities and communities, she calls us to action. She says we need to commit to ensuring that every child has access to a quality school. And this is how. We create an equitable structure that is supported by community leaders. This structure should ensure that all schools are healthy and reflect the diversity of the area. And I know that in Topeka, I don't know as much about Manhattan schools, this has not been the case. We do have schools where majority low-income students and students of color go to school. She says that we need places where the low-income and kids of color kids are not in a few schools together while white and economically advantaged kids are all together. We should also invest in early childhood programs that reach all kids, not just the few that we can squeak in, the 3% that manage to get there first. And that we should invest in offering before and after school programming that is high quality and enriching. To the rest of us, and perhaps this is some of you in the room, she encourages advocacy and service. As neighbors and community leaders, we need to protect the most vulnerable in our communities first, to make sure all families have access to basic needs so that kids come to school with a foundation. to support all kids and families, not just the ones we're related to or the ones that we know personally or the ones that go to our congregation, but all the kids in our community. Communities have to organize against the forces in our community that create poor conditions and prevent our kids from flourishing, conditions that promote individualism and consumerism, environmental destruction and violence, sexualization and oppression. Essentially, we need to stop being bystanders to these influences in our communities. Theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer says that the test of morality in a society is how it treats its children. Based on this assessment, and you heard it in the description of your shelter here this morning, we would score very low. We are a moral failure as a community and a nation. Edelman says that every responsible adult needs to ask ourselves Bonhoeffer's question: in a world awash with nuclear and conventional weapons, whose costs today are a theft from those who are hungry, sick, uneducated, homeless, and helpless. The faith leaders and their communities, Edelman surmises that there are many opportunities to make a difference that we are not acting on. We could do so much more from our faith communities in particular that we're not doing or that not enough of us are doing. We need to open our doors and create spaces for children and families to come and find safe spaces to learn and grow and be in community, not just on Sunday and not just for our own members. We need to be vital participants in our communities. She invites us to respond to the needs we see, from foster children's needs to homeless people's needs. We need to teach the histories of all people, she says, and tell the stories of all people. People of color need to know the stories about their leaders and their contributions. They need to hear us speak out against domestic violence and racism, child abuse and sexual violence, misogyny and trafficking. They need to hear where we stand on these issues and that we will stand up for them and with them. We need to find ways to desegregate Sunday and develop relationships beyond our congregations and between our congregations. As people of faith, we also need to advocate for real changes in policy and government spending that support families and children and challenge rather than mimic the dominant culture. It's time for us to use our extraordinary power to change and to support. We need to commit to reaching out to at-risk families and helping prevent children from being removed from families due to poverty and prevent youth from being placed in detention. We need to speak out against tax cuts for the wealthy that are accompanied by cuts to programs needed by low-income families. We need to support families in adopting out of foster care and support families who foster children. Maybe there are families like this in your congregation you could be supporting right now. We need to work with other congregations to offer quality summer and after-school programs that last most of the summer, that mentor kids in the juvenile system or foster care. We need to partner with local schools to celebrate kids who are beating the odds and develop scholarships to support them and their future in college or technical schools. And we need to offer opportunities and support programs that build the character of our kids. This is so much more important than test scores. Locally and nationally, many organizations do work to support these actions, and we can engage in this work with them. Kansas Action for Children and the Children's Defense Fund are just two examples of organizations we can help. The Children's Defense Fund notes that it is a national moral disgrace that children remain the poorest age group in the United States of America, one of the richest countries in the world. Nearly one in five children, 12.8 million in total, were poor in 2017. Over 45% of these children lived in extreme poverty at less than half the poverty level. And nearly 70% of poor children were children of color. About one in three American Indian, Alaska Native children, and more than one in four Black and Hispanic children were poor, compared with one in nine white children. The youngest children are most likely to be poor, with one in five children under the age of five living in poverty during years of rapid brain development. If you don't think this has consequences for all of us, you're not looking very far down the pike. Child poverty hurts children and our nation's future. It creates gaps in cognitive skills for very young children and puts children at greater risk of hunger and homelessness, jeopardizes their health and ability to learn, and fuels the intergenerational cycle of poverty. So we need to make sure that all children's basic needs are met, The children have a safe, affordable place to live, and they have access to food that's healthy. We need to support programs that target these needs and support kids. Not surprisingly, we need to increase employment and make work pay. Kids need parents with jobs that provide wages that can sustain a family. That seems so obvious, yeah? But we're not doing it. Also, families need affordable and high-quality childcare options so that parents can work without neglecting their kids. We've seen 2,000 more kids end up in foster care in our state, and the majority of those kids are there not because of abuse, but because of neglect, and the neglect has come because parents are working 2 and 3 jobs to try to keep a roof over their heads and food on the table. They don't have the money for childcare. We need to level the playing field for poor children. Kids need access to affordable health and mental health care, as well as affordable, high-quality early development and learning opportunities. They need high-performing schools and colleges and families and neighborhoods that are free from violence. So here in Kansas, we also learned from Kansas Action for Children that childhood poverty is on the rise. Nearly 1 in 4 Kansas children lives in poverty, as opposed to the 1 in 5 at the national level. The Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF, provides resources to help the poorest families meet their basic needs, but a decreasing portion of the state's TANF dollars is being used for core services that aid family needs, like cash assistance, employment services, and child care. Kansas has had at one time as much as $41 million in TANF reserves. Instead of maintaining these large reserves, we need to use these dollars to lift children out of poverty. Kansas is out of step with the rest of the nation, we find. For every 100 Kansas families with children in poverty, fewer than 17 received benefits in 2012. The national average was about 26 recipients of TANF for every 100 poor families. We're not doing well on either level, but you can see that Kansas is behind the game as well. The Kansas Department of Children and Families that administers TANF and has a responsibility to help poor families succeed, but they've created tougher eligibility rules, increased sanctions, and shorter time limits keep people from qualifying for help and force others off the program before they've achieved self-sufficiency. Last year, Kansas marked a significant achievement. We had a record low infant mortality rate. However, a closer look at our infant mortality information reveals that black Kansas babies remain roughly 3 times as likely to die as white babies due to a variety of systemic barriers. We can't be satisfied until these infant mortality reductions are realized for every Kansas child. We can and we must do better. Research shows stress of racial discrimination is part of what's linked to the higher rates of infant mortality. Despite the increase in insurance rates for Kansas children overall, black and Latinx children in Kansas remain twice as likely as their white counterparts to be without health insurance. And roughly 1 in 10 black children, 10%, and Latinx, 9% Kansas children do not have health insurance, compared with about 4% of white children. Kansas Action for Children influences public policy that provides Kansas children with the opportunities they need to achieve their full potential. And their work to improve the lives of Kansas children and their families, similar to the Children's Defense Fund, Kansas Action for Children focuses on both state and federal policy issues in the areas of health, education, and economic stability. This legislative session, I hope that you'll watch for updates from them and as well from Kansas Interfaith Action about what's happening in our state legislature to hopefully begin to address some of these issues. But we have to push for it because there's lots of folks who don't want to do anything about it. We have many opportunities to shift the state of Kansas and our country from being a place where children and families are under attack to being a sanctuary, a place of protection and nurture and transformation, a place where healing is available and safety is paramount. And this month, as we consider what it means to be a community of sanctuary, both here in your congregation and home in mine, I invite you to consider what it would look like if we focused on the most vulnerable members of our community who can't vote and whose future is literally the future of all of us. If you had a team of people here at the UU Fellowship in Manhattan who worked closely with organizations like Kansas Action for Children and Kansas Interfaith Action and worked with similar teams from other faith communities, the way that MAPJ has been doing work in this community, and across the state, our impact and our voice would be so much greater. As Marion Wright Edelman says, service is the rent we pay for being. It is the very purpose of life and not something you do in your spare time. So I hope that each of you will find ways to be of service together and across the community. And may we find ourselves becoming communities that embody new possibilities as a result of our service. Blessed be. May it be so. Won't you stand and join me in singing number one, May Nothing Evil Cross the Store. May I become at all times, both now and forever, a protector of those without protection, a guide for those who have lost their way, a ship for those with oceans to cross, a bridge for those with rivers to cross, a sanctuary for those in danger, and a lamp for those without light, a place of refuge for those who lack shelter, and a servant to all in need. For as long as space endures, and for as long as living beings remain, until then, may I too abide. Go in peace. Stay for community.